For purposes of identification, this is a forum. I'm Erling Jorsted from St. Olaf, and the title or the topic for tonight was suggested by one of the guests, and I'll call on him now for the exact wording, or as exact as you can come up with. It is, I think it's a delightful idea. John didn't give me the sheet, so.
Can pious, subjective, emotional Norwegian Haugianism deal at home with rational, logical, modernistic, humanistic LCAers in the new church?
Okay.
Or some combination thereof.
Okay, that's one way where we can, one place where we can start. Does anybody else want to put another question or two in front of us so we can get them out on the agenda? Because as John was talking about, I wish John were here. I found out about this 2 minutes before he made the announcement. But we'd want it just as a topic on specific tensions within the these two Lutheran families, but on the whole general area of church unity, what we can do, what we can't do, where we're called to cooperate, where there may be some differences with her, and what this is really all about. I'd like to start with, John said, I'd like to start with a story, even though John said I could do this if I could, didn't tell a story.
Is that you wouldn't tell too many.
I wouldn't tell too many. Well, not tell too many. All right, just one. I grew up in an area, some of you know, where there were 10 Norwegian, or still are, not the word, there still are 10 Norwegian Lutheran churches within 8 miles. And a sociologist would call that cultural homogeneity. In fact, the township where I grew up, there were only Norwegian Lutheran farmers. And that's 36 miles square. You know, that's a lot of farm. When no farm was more than 200 acres, you get some understanding of the background. And of those 10 Norwegian Lutheran churches, 2 were Hauge. You'd think that 8 Norwegian Lutheran churches would be enough, but no, the Haugies came in and added 2 more, Asplund East and Asplund West. That doesn't mean anything to you, but it's hilariously funny to me. So that sort of illustrates the what I want to try to give out to the story. Anyway, back in the late part of the 19th century, early 20th century, there were some tremendous doctrinal battles raging throughout the various synods. I don't know how many. I think there were something like 17 Norwegian Lutheran groups before the first merger took place. You wouldn't think that there were that many valleys in Norway for people to come from to start their own church over here, because oftentimes the synods were nothing really much more than what valley in Norway or I dare say Sweden or Denmark, you're Finland, you came from anyway. So the doctrinal battles were going on over all strange things, predestination, what you think we would have left to the Calvinists, because it's just one of those chicken and egg kind of debates. But anyway, that didn't daunt the good church fathers. And the debate raged not only at the seminaries in St. Louis and Rock Island. The seminary was at Rock Island going by that time, by the turn of the century. Sure it was. And the one in St. Paul and various ones in between in Nebraska and so on. But it spread throughout the various churches, and there was a great deal of controversy over it. And the ministers were trying, especially in the rural areas, trying very hard to explain the implications of this doctrine of predestination and the theological implications of the whole thing for them. And in the church at that particular time, there wasn't a great deal, except among the clergy, there wasn't a great deal of theological sophistication. And at the particular sort of what you might call the mother congregation of all Norwegian Lutherans in Minnesota, and that, interestingly enough, and it's a totally a coincidence, but that church, interestingly enough, is named Holden also. It's a name for a valley in Norway from which the people came, because they usually named their church, in America for the valley or the city or whatever it is from where they came, Gold and Asplund and so many of the others. All right, anyway, this was the Holden Lutheran Church, right in the center of where I was born and raised. And the pastor explained all the theological implications, pro and con, gave a very fair and accurate, complete discussion of the whole battle over predestination. And then it threw it open for comment from the audience. And it went back and forth, and finally one old, grizzled resident of the area stood up and said, I don't know about all the rest of these things, but if whatever the Preusses and the Ulversacher say, that's okay with me. Well, some of you weren't supposed to laugh because that's something that some over here did with, because they understand this. And of course, to have done it really right, I should have said it in Norwegian, but you know, I wouldn't want to do that. But the point that I want to make is that even today, I think you can find elements within Lutheranism, I can't speak for the other, you know, the church families, which are more loyal to personality and to sort of family connections than they are really to anything else. And one of the battles and one of the real problems, even though Lutherans are supposed to be so, you know, concerned and involved with, you know, doctrine and pure, what we like to call purity of doctrine, that the outside world can't quite understand if we all, you know, take our cue at least for the beginning from Martin Luther and the Small Catechism, Book of Concord and all the rest. Why is it that there can be such divisions, and why have these divisions lasted, you know, from let's say 1517 to, you know, to 1983, which, you know, is a fairly long time. And now we have a little more emphasis on Luther because of the 500-year celebration thing. And the point I wanted to make with that particular story is that people didn't really fully understand the implications of the doctrinal battles, because in the Lutheran Church for a long time there was a terrific split between the educated clergy on the one hand and the laity on the other, and there really wasn't any sort of in between. Because the Lutheran Church came primarily to rural and small town areas, and it took a long time for them to get the colleges, the Augustanas and the St. Olaf's and the Gustavuses and the Luthers, started so that you could get an educated laity. And hence, there developed a rather significant split, and people tended, for whatever reasons, to associate with personalities like the Preusses and the Ulversachers. Those are the two great names with Luther College, for a long, long time. And if you went to Luther, that's, what I'm talking about here. Okay. So I think that would be, my sort of opening statement, and probably the only joke, that I'll tell. But that one seems to have some sort of purpose for this, and I would like to ask you if you think we've got a legitimate problem on the basis of the topic that you mentioned for us.
Well, I think the problem is going to become more acute as we get closer to the merger, because at least from the perspective of one pastor, from viewing America from Southern California, and I know that those eyes are not the best with which to view America at times, but that even in our own communities, the tensions, and let's just use the words fundamentalist, liberal kind of polarity that we have, we find some real tensions existing already. And in the midst of the merger, how in the world are we going to begin to overcome some of those tensions that exist in this broad spectrum? And the way that I try to attack the problem is to take a look at, to see if we can discover out of this whole milieu of Lutheranism, what I would call are the non-negotiables of the faith. Mm-hmm. The handful of points that really do unite us and over which around which there is essential unity, and then list underneath those the negotiables. And the negotiables at that point being those things that really, I don't know if you want to put the whole question of the charismatic movement within the negotiable frame, whether it be the subjective feeling, emotional versus the rational, intellectual approach under the negotiable. But how can we begin to sense the essential unity, give room for that tremendous amount of negotiable material that's there without being judgmental and putting other people down and saying, oh, there he goes, another pietist, or there he goes, another, or she goes, another rationalist without the feet on the ground, spiritually speaking. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. How are we going to do that in the Lutheran Church?
Okay, we put that one up on the agenda. Does anybody else want to add to the list of things we should be considering with this particular topic? This a forum is something where everybody comes together. Don't look to me, I feel, usually this is a position of power. you know, the throne and everything, right now I feel quite insignificant here. I feel like people are watching me. I would just as soon have input from, you know, the circle, because as I said before, I think the best way for a discussion is not for this, for me to be sort of like a radar station where people start over here and bounce it off here and then it goes over here, but, you know, to get everybody involved here. But I think this is a nice way of putting it, Tom.
Yeah, it came up earlier in one of the talks about how today people are breaking off in different groups for single issues.
Single issues, right.
And are finding themselves united very strongly for single issues, i.e., you mentioned it once, the charismatic movement cuts across all kinds of lines. Those people who are interested in the nuclear issue, that cuts across all sorts of lines and denominations. The issue of abortion certainly cuts across. And so we find those sort of issues are much more important for a number of people than the older, established doctrinal questions.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Is the tension that we're talking about, that you're mentioning here, really sort of a tension among the, you know, the leaders and not as much among the laity? Is it a matter of those who have been in positions of you know, policy making and decision making for a long time, and that if what Tom is saying is, you know, even partially correct, that there is more enthusiasm for unity and cooperation, you know, on the lay level, without much concern for preoccupation with all the business that goes on, you know, for the talks for unity among the, between the two largest or the three denominations. Rudy.
Yeah, I think it's sometimes wise to look at some points in this kind of a situation where the two are already together. For example, California Lutheran College is the only college in the two synods that's jointly owned by the ALC and the LCA. Uh-huh. Here, the problem had to come directly in the focus. Uh-huh. And it did. There was a necessity to have a college in that area. It couldn't be done really well by either the ALC or the LCA. And so they joined for a very good and sufficient reason. And that has worked out very well. And it's still working out. And I think I see Holden community as really a very good example of how these things can come together. And I see that even broader than the LCA and the ALC, we have also the Missouri Church very much represented in this community, and we do work together.
Yeah. I can't help but refrain when somebody else might be thinking about something else they want to comment here. The response to you about if it worked in California, maybe that's a portent, because there's that old couplet. What is it? Rejoice, my friends, let your heart leap up, or else mourn with sorrow, for what California is today, America will be tomorrow. Yeah.
And then we have a problem.
We have a problem, yeah. And the very good water.
I don't find my people that sophisticated in the particular parish I'm serving at this point. You know, I've served three parishes that are radically different in makeup. But, you know, I just think of a California congregation that's made up mainly of people who have Midwestern roots, Midwestern heritage. And I'll be doing a Bible study, and for many of us, this is so passé that you just think it's why in the world do we bring it up? But I suggest, well, maybe, you know, Adam and Eve weren't the first two people, and maybe Adam and Eve really, Adam simply means mankind, and it may have been, you know, a few hundred thousand years ago, and there's this horror, this consternation, that a Lutheran minister would be saying something like that and getting away from what the Bible says. So there's that strand within Lutheranism that I'm having a difficult time from an LCA pastor looking at some strands of Lutheranism. I'm sure that from the other direction, they're saying some of the things that I'm saying. You know, if God wants to create by evolution, great, go ahead, because all scientists are going to discover how God does it. They're going to look at me with tremendous, and they have, with tremendous amounts of suspicion in terms of my credentials, you know, as an LCA pastor.
Now, might it be that for some people within the Lutheran community, that, you know, doctrine is basic and fundamental, and so they look more at areas where there might be differences, whereas for what Tom is saying is right, most, at least many other people aren't that preoccupied at all with doctrine and growth would rather get on with other areas, you know, for cooperation. And isn't that maybe one of the barriers or one of the real problems that we're facing when we're going ahead with this? That some people feel that it's doctrine, you know, you stand with the Preusses and the Oversockers on pure doctrine, and
I also see a reversal in roles. In the 50s and 60s with the ecumenical movement, it appeared to be coming from above.
Yep.
And the sort of things which are happening now seem to be grassroots. And the hierarchy seems to be stuck in the theological things. That is, if you go ask your Catholic bishop if you can take communion with the Lutherans, he would like to say yes, but he's stuck with a no. And it seems like there's those problems. They can't quite work out, and everyone else at a different level, a lower level, is not having problems with those.
Yeah. Are we saying here that there's a tension between the clergy on the one hand and the laity on the other, that in some things the clergy is more what you might call sophisticated and the laity is less? Is that? I just want to get everybody in.
Some of the problem is just an inability to communicate. We're dealing with a large number of people in a large nation. And I think a lot of people, including myself, are maybe thinking, or in my case, concerned that it's maybe more of a theology of bureaucracy that's taking place rather than maybe a theology of community. And I think maybe within the laity and within congregational life, maybe it's just seen as something that has already happened, that there's been the vote to make the steps towards merger, and now all that is happening is setting aside, well, how do you handle the seminary ties, and how do you handle the different ties there? Maybe somehow there needs to be more communication happening.
Okay, we're getting going here.
Well, I think there are a couple of things operating. There is, what true is typified by one parishioner of mine that moved to another town and called up and said, what's the difference if you put the A at the beginning or at the end? And so that he wanted to check out because the nearest church was ALC and we have the LCA. I think another thing that is a struggle is kind of a question that throws in here is a geographical question, because the congregation that I come from just now has got a couple of Andersons in it. It never had an Anderson in it, and it has a couple of Hansons, and it never had any Hansons. We have a lot of other non-Scandinavian names. And so some of the questions that are being raised in other places are not the same questions being raised in Eastern Oregon, because we don't have that ethnic tie. One of my predecessors tried to instill a ethnic Scandinavian tradition of Santa Lucia, and the people didn't know what it was all about. But we did it at PLU, you know? But there was not a sense of the ownership of that tradition. So there's a geographical difference, I think, of the regionalism, differences operating, which, because the questions that are being raised there are not the questions that I've had in our congregation. So I think that's another.
Okay, that's another thing to put up there in front and considering this. Sure, go ahead.
The question that has been bothering me for some time is what does it mean to have a Lutheran church that tries to encompass such a large country? I mean, whether you're talking about LCA or the new church or whatever, I mean, what we're talking about is that no matter where you go, no matter what church you're in, there are so many different questions, so many different realities. What does it mean to call, to unite them under one single name? I mean, I guess there seems to be such a diversity of that. Why do it? Because if we do that, then it has to go from the top down. There has to be a certain level of bureaucracy, of trying to control things from these levels with issues that a lot of people on the bottom don't deal with, because they come from somewhere else and they don't. There is no common bond as there used to be. The American culture seems to be so diverse, so pluralistic. What sense does it make to try and create some sense of unity that comes from the top down and is simply an organizational unity without ever having a real common tradition?
That's a very profound, question. like somebody to address that to that or something, you know, allied to it. Go ahead.
You know, I had the privilege of serving on the LCR steering committee in Seattle for the last year, and that issue came up, has been up all year, and what the shepherding committee that met last month in Minneapolis said was they're going to start a non-geographical synod as soon as the merger hits, and Larry Christensen is going to be the head of this thing, and it's going to be a non-geographical synod. It's going to be a synod within a synod, and this is in the planning stages now because that is a question that is going across the board.
Like the old English synod in the Missouri?
I don't know. That it's
around which? What is going to be the?
There's going to be a tie that will be between the LCA and the LC congregations that won't be geographical.
It'll be more of a type of
a tie
ministry.
Because that issue.
Would that be like the Slovak Synod of the LCA that meets separately but I mean they have no functional apparatus or anything. I mean they are within the synod, so I mean the
and totally in supportive to the
right,
to the
right.
Synod too.
It was a language thing from the Slovak point of view, as I understand it. But that the new church doesn't eliminate any desire for that, though, does it? The special.
It's been tossed around.
You know what I maybe am hearing here is perhaps there are, you know, a significant number of problems, communications, geographical loyalties, and all the rest of these things, which will mean that the talk of a unified church is simply being superimposed, whereas probably. You know, a significant number of people aren't ready for it or aren't interested in it or simply bored by it or what? Is that what I'm hearing or what, Rudy?
Well, I think there's another facet in terms of education.
Okay.
There are very fundamental differences in philosophies between the ALC and the LCA, as I feel, in terms of the education system within the two churches. The ALC is very much top-oriented and works down from Minneapolis throughout the whole synod. The LCA tends to be split up and very rational and more decentralized in that sense. And to put these two systems together into one church now to make it operate functionally is going to take some doing, and you know they're good questions to be raised on both sides as to which should really survive.
Okay, somebody else want to comment on that?
Okay,
yeah, sure.
But I guess the question I have is what difference does that make for the people in the pews? I mean, how is that going to affect them? Yeah, there are differences in systems and structures and organizational procedures, but how does that interface with the central message of the gospel of Christ? How does that interface with the preaching of the gospel? It seems to be a bureaucratic question.
Okay.
I had the privilege to sit on a lecture by Joe Sittler last summer talking about merger and things like this. And as the LCA is set up, it's set up more on a pastor congregational ministry, and as the ALC is set up, it's more focused on more of a congregational ministry, a congregational call. Now, I am not a member of the AELC, but from what Joe Sittler said, the AELC has set up their purpose not to set up congregations, not to set up pastors and congregations, but to witness to the community the gospel message of Christ. And I think that perhaps maybe this is something that comes out of merger. I think that one of the exciting things to come out of merger is to re-examine what the purpose of Lutherans are doing here in the United States. Where are we going with that gospel message? And then how can we, and this comes down to what does it do to the person in the pew, how does this start to impact into the person in the pew? This is a great chance for us to reorientate our thinking or to do some reevaluation. And but my concern is that again, there's not the filtering down that this is happening with the theologians and the Council of 70 and stuff like this, but somehow local people, as such, we are not getting into the spirit of it, maybe, or something.
Do you think it's too early for that? It's 83 and the target date is 88.
Well, I think, you know, there's some stuff coming, they've just released some papers on it, and that is getting it out. I think that maybe on a congregational level, congregations should start asking for some of these, because, I mean, there is material being published, produced, and perhaps this is the time for forums to be set up within congregations to start discussing these issues. What does it mean? What are the differences right now between the ALC and LCA? Why can't we just get together now? I mean, why are we going through all the theological hocus-pocus? Maybe now is the time for some forums within congregational life to start asking some of these questions of why, and in fact, why are we Lutheran?
Response to that?
Oh, yeah. I was smiling because why are we Lutheran? That's a good question. I wanted to respond to what you were saying and then to what you were saying. I come from the Canadian context, yeah. And we just sort of tuned into the merger in the States. Last year, I guess, at the convention, we were really excited about that. I'll just share some things that I've observed there and maybe see if it fits for you here. In terms of how it affects the people in the pew, I can speak about my small congregation, the only one that I've served so far. They really don't care. They get worried when they start thinking it's going to cost them money. And it is. In fact, the ELC out of Saskatoon is planning a $1 million drive for next, they're hoping to kick it off next September. And our people don't know about this yet. And I'm reluctant to share that information, in a sense. So there, I've had several people in my congregation heard other pastors say that when it starts costing money, then they're going to. Otherwise, they don't see what the difference is, except maybe in tradition. And in Canada, I think the ethnic ties between Scandinavian, or the difference between Scandinavian and German tradition is very strong. And if it means that bilingual service will no longer be held in Zion Lutheran, then there's going to be some real problems. So we have a different ethnic sort of thing. I would say the other thing, there is some enthusiasm behind it. As you were talking, though, about the difference in method between LCA and ALC, we can really see this right now, and the tension is starting between the theologians and, or between the pastors right now. I can speak in our particular district in the Fraser Valley around Vancouver area. We notice ELC people are noticing, and for a while we're threatened by the LCA's method of operating. They came in with I hadn't heard that term rationalistic before, but they came in with a very deliberate kind of setup, political, very shrewd political maneuvers and so forth. They had three people actively campaigning for bishop in the D.C. district, and ELC was kind of laid back thinking, we'll work this out in our kind of homespun way, and all of a sudden these guys are going around campaigning in actually one of our congregations and with our lay people individually. So this spring we got together, ALC pastors got together and decided we have to meet this LCA front head on. It turns out the front can meet, and there are enough people that can meet in the phone booth. Pastors in that area, but they're very sharp and they're aggressive, and our style is democratic, more democratic, let the majority decide. So we're noticing the strain right now
and we've gone through a phase, we have to make up our mind in August. You know, the for an October meeting, that's the final merger committee meeting. And there's a certain strain right now, but we're sort of working through that. Now, this is in the West Coast, it's entirely different in Ontario, and I can't really speak about that very well. I guess what I would distill out of that for you is that the process goes on, and from the Canadian perspective, the process goes on, and there are a lot of feelings that need to be aired along the way. In our case, I'm not so sure in the American context that it's really necessary. In our case, it's necessary. Because if LCA doesn't merge with ELC, by the time 1988 rolls around, they're going to be kind of swamped in Ontario and they're going to be by themselves. They've been used to a lot of money and so forth pumped in through New York and programs. Their pastors can get on the phone and call someone out. And they have excellent programs, resources for the congregation. ELC, being a new church, hasn't had that. And they're getting scared. We're getting scared. But there's some enthusiasm behind it. And I guess that's all I'll say. I've said enough already.
There's one of the really nitty gritty issues that I'd like to get some response to, particularly from some of you who are in the Midwest, because I've never lived in the Midwest. I'm Western born and bred, and I have certain stereotypes about the Midwest that may need to be clarified. But, for instance, our last Synod Convention adopted a resolution that calls on every congregation of our Synod to support any pastor or layperson who is involved in civil disobedience when it comes to the question of the nuclear freeze. That is a political, but we feel also a theologically oriented political question. As I shared that with just some persons here from the Midwest, I feel that the reaction was sort of horror and consternation that a LCA synod would take that kind of a position, becoming so political. I see that as a theological issue. In getting into dialogue and conversation then, again, to create sort of a stereotype, but I think there's reality behind it, is that no, the real way that the issue is solved is through prayer before Jesus. And that by changing people individually, that's the way the nation will be changed, but not to go to those steps in terms of the statements before Senate conventions. Okay. That's kind of a reflection I'd like to get some research.
Sure. Yeah. You talk about the differences between the different synods. There's as much difference within each synod and within each pastor as there is between synods.
David Price has taken a very strong stand.
You know, and the people within the church.
So you're suggesting that perhaps if what you perceive to be true is the case, that this might be a very serious source of tension as the union proceeds.
I would think so. Particularly given the mobility now of America, as people begin to move around, are we going to be almost setting up subcultures within this new church that might be destructive someplace along the way? I guess the question I'm struggling with right at this point is, how can we create that kind of attitude of acceptance of the tremendous differences that we have in an affirmative way in the presence of Christ without them deteriorating into that kind of destructive, judgmental, well, some of the things that you have indicated, some of the cult groups, or some of those things that may come tumbling out of this. What can we do right now to shape our attitude so that if we hear something coming from someone who is different than, saying something different than what we are accustomed to hearing, but rather than judging them immediately, and from my perspective, for instance, I put my prejudice out on the table. There goes another one of those pious Norwegians who wants to pray at the drop of a hat as though it were a magic wand in the sky that's going to do the homework of the hard, nitty-gritty digging and solving the problem. How can I, that's my problem at that moment, that I've got to reach out and really be open in that direction in the same kind of way that I hope they would want to reach out and say, well, gee, why is it he says what he says? Well, maybe I can learn something from him. What can we do right now to start shaping those attitudes that when the confrontations do come, and it's not a matter of if, but when, that we can be in a listening, accepting, non-judgmental posture and really reflect to the world the multiplicity that's here in a constructive way. Can it happen? Or are some of these feelings too deep, and are we going to have some hurts when we start meeting head on? We were talking at the table today just about the whole charismatic thing. I've had a little bit of experience with it, and I must say that originally, 5, 6, 7 years ago, a charismatic to me is a no-no. You know, right away before I would even have known you, you would have been put into a corner and into a little box, and I would have had all kinds of feelings about you because of some charismatic tinges. Where, how do we, what do we do in these kinds of questions?
It's a good question. It's a forum, so I just want to invite your responses. Most of the responses have come from clergy. I'd be willing to, wanting to, please.
Well, what I'm hearing is something that I think is just really neat, to think that God created us, and if he wanted us all to think alike and thought that had to be that very important, he would have made us that way. But he's made us all to be able to think differently and still be able to work together. And to me, this is just really great that we've got different feelings about different things, and yet we can still work together, but we don't always have to agree on every issue. And that God feels, he must feel, that it isn't important that we have agree on everything, or he would have said so. The only thing he said we had to agree on is how we felt about him and his son.
We've been working in the in Washington State on through our ecumenical statewide agency on why peace is so divisive in the church. And we found as we struggled with that and came back with things that we recommend to do in those kinds of settings, they were coming back to the same old basic things that in any kind of division seem to work pretty well. And that is that we tend very quickly to move to what's the right doctrine, what's the right way to believe, or what's the right thing to do before we've taken time to learn about one another in terms of, you know, well, how do you feel about this merger? You know, which is kind of what we're doing here,
yeah,
which is neat.
Yeah, yeah.
And not only that, but how did you come to be who you are with the kinds of concerns that you've got? You know, and when I think of trying to apply that, one would be in congregational settings of LCA and ALC folk meeting together and kind of beginning to share in small settings, you know, what's important about who they are and where they came from. And maybe even on a church-wide basis of, you know, we have all these, the Lutheran's a nice magazine, but I mean, it has its blasés. We could take some time in there maybe to review some of the history that shaped different portions of the church and how it was, what made those things work, what made those things have power for people in history. Kind of share those across the board. Same way, you know, between charismatic and non-charismatic, between peacemaker and person that's not so sure about that, between to take time and say, what shaped me, what made me who I am, and let the other person listen to that and go back and forth with it. Then you can start to talk about, well, what's the best way to compromise on this issue or something. We move so quickly into our compromises and our settlings out.
Okay. More communication is what you're, you know, suggesting.
Well, especially on feelings rather than facts and decisions.
If your observation is correct, that it's been, and I don't know who the pastors are, but it's mainly clergy who are talking right now, and I would suspect that a bunch of you are not clergy, you are lay people. Could the same thing be happening right here in this circle that may happen later on in our discussions? So where are you lay people are you going to sleep? Are you yawning? Is this really a battle between, in terms of the bureaucracy, the clergy? And you're just going to come along and twink your noses whatever way we push the button?
I think it's
Where are you?
I think it's even worse than that. I think that from my discussions with laity, they think that we're out in left field. My people are saying, I really don't see what the big deal is. I mean, look at the world where I work every day, you know, and I come back here, and here we are, and we're cousins, and, you know, the differences are so minor. So the folks that I'm working with all day long, this is, you clergy are off in left field, hassling over nits, and we want to get on with business. And then we're going, well, you don't really understand all the implications of this and how terrible it's going to be. I'm the AS.
Yeah.
Here's my bias again, but I really believe, and I'm talking to people with the committee that I served on last year and the school that I went to last year, the last couple years, this thing, the lay people, you want a response from the lay people, I really believe that this merger needs to be bathed, it needs to be bathed in prayer. And the lay people are praying their buns off, trying to bring unity in this whole thing. And that, again, I lay that on the table, that sounds really fishy for maybe too simplistic, that this thing needs to be bathed in prayer and then letting God the Father bring unity in this whole thing. Yes, we need to deal with these issues from a rational point of view, but I believe in the midst of that, the Spirit of God can work unity in this and will if we allow Him to. And if we just bathe it in prayer, and I know a lot of lay people are, that's their response. A lot of people are praying about this.
Well, you know, as a lay person from the balcony here,
we all have to.
Through 3 days of a regional conference last year, June, listening to the merger, and I came out of it with a feeling, and I still have it, as just a lay person in the church, that if this were, we had a group of corporations, there might be some reason for merger. Management oftentimes is a little cheaper, centralized, and maybe this would be from that viewpoint, but from a church viewpoint, it seems to me, I feel, and like my grandmother did, if anything is working well, leave it alone. And perhaps I felt that way about the hymn book. Can we change from one hymn book to another? But it seems like much ado about nothing. And most of the people that I know feel much the same way. It might be good for the clergy, but I can't just see where it's good for, that has any great point for the people.
Thank you.
Well, I guess, you know, my personal opinion about the marriage, I really agree with you about bathing it in prayer, and I think that this type of discussion needs to take place too. There has to be, prayer is also action in the world, so I think that there's got to be some kind of action in your life as far as this. And I guess as far as for the theology of this, I just think the idea of the unity within the body of Christ calls us to continue to try to find those things that we can share in common with each other, and to continue to work towards that one communion. Sometimes we talk of it in mystical senses, and sometimes we talk about in pragmatic senses. But I think that this is one way. As someone said, we're like kissing cousins or something. You know, we can do some real work again, some real understanding, some real education about. Where our faith journey together lies, and in that sense, it's a great moment for me. I think that it's a big point for the church.
The same God, the same Jesus. What we're really working at is on an administrative level. That's the way it looks to me.
Well, I think that's I'm afraid that's how it's coming across. But I think that there's a greater theological concern in this than just administrative hocus pocus. I know some people have come back from in February they had groups of pastors and lay people go back
and hear papers that the Council of 70 was coming back. And one pastor came back and said, you know, the question was basically, how Episcopalian are we going to be? But I think that there are some real chances here for growth in our life as a communion. And I think if we limit ourselves to the administrative side, that we've really sold ourselves down the river. And that if that's what's happening, then we, as people of the body of Christ, need to do prayer. We need to do action within what is happening, to start finding out what is happening. We have, you know, the government. We have a responsibility. The government is not for them, it is us. The church is not them, the theologians, the pastors. The church is us. We are all called to the priesthood of believers. And so I think that there's a great chance for the action of spirit here.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. As a student at Cal Lutheran, with the two churches coming together, we have a lot of ALCA people. And I think a position, as I grow with various people and sharing ideas and our ideas of what our faith is, we don't see the main concerns of faith are not, there aren't really that many divisions between the ALC and LCA. There's usually not a question, you know, oh, yeah. It's not an issue. It's kind of like the ALC-LCA merger in the bureaucracy, just kind of catching up with the real issues as far as our faith, because we see the similarities. Maybe it's because we're in California. I don't know if those similarities get mixed a little closer together. And at the same time, respecting that the individual faiths are still there. There's, like people were saying earlier, you know, the difference is every congregation is going to have its own personality. Each individual is going to carry their own individuality. We're not going to ever polish off so closely that we're all going to be that similar. But as far as the bureaucracy, it's an important issue to sort through. But I think we can still look, and we shouldn't be frustrated in the little detail.
Yeah, in the back, and then Joel, go ahead.
Well, as I see it from a right lane point of view, we voted, at least in the state of Iowa, I think 5 dissensions to merge. That is overwhelming. We have the common service book we agreed on. We got the Bible, and we got Luther's Catechism. Now, why we have to study for 5 years whether we ought to merge or not is beyond human comprehension, as far as I'm concerned. What we should have done immediately is to have set up the structure, got a new chairman, president, and gone ahead and merged. The longer we talk, 5 years now, we're going to talk for 5 years, we're going to find more reasons why we can't merge, in my opinion. Part of the thing is any detail that has nothing to do with the basics that we need right in our hand away. We've got a nice green book we've all agreed on. We may not like all the hymns.
I've heard Hocus Pocus and Hanky Panky so far. I don't know where we're going with that one.
Because when you give yourself 5 years to talk, you're bound to come up with more things that you can't agree on. But when we've got the elements, we've got the essentials right in our hands we've already agreed on.
Okay, Joe.
I'm a non-Lutheran. I'm asking this for information. I'd just like to I'd like to know this. Is there a generational difference? I mean, is it, you know, would you think that you're talking about your differences vertically, but could there be a layer difference, like the younger generation see it one way and the older generation see it another? I'm asking that question. I don't know.
I'm not so sure.
Go ahead. I've been that. Speaking out of the Augustana, which has your voices, and I'm one of the kind of have some of that old, talk about the old Augustana in it, and a lot of my classmates aren't really part of that, but I come out of a very strong tradition of that, through several generations of pastors and so forth, and I think that's dying out, so you find less of that holding up, because there's still, amongst some of the older, here in the Northwest,
idea, one of the considerations as we elected a new bishop was the Augustana, and because they were still part of that generation.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, is dying down. And so I think that's a good point, Joe. But
it dies hard, because there's always the suspicions, and you're absolutely right that it seems to me, and what I'm hearing from my own observations, that we oftentimes bring, you know, our own preferences, and this is what we personally would like to see done, rather than simply, you know, as you say, bathing in prayer and seeing what happens from that point. And I think this is a very real issue that I don't see making, you know, any significant headway, at least so far. Maybe there's a breakthrough. I have to say, on the other hand, from the historical perspective, people were saying things like this in the mid to the late 1950s. I wish I had Cliff Nelson's charts of how many, you know, different, you know, I think there were 100, Cliff is the sort of the unofficial historian of American Lutheranism, and he lives in Northfield with good friends. But anyway, he's found, I think, 117 different groups at one time or another. Now we're down to four.
I think it was 150.
That many, okay. Because Cliff loves to find all these little ones and splinters of splinters. And so on. And so what I'm hearing now has to be, and I think, set in the context of what was being said in the 1950s and many of the, you know, the horror stories and the predictions from that time. Whatever happened to the old ELC, you know, you could play this alphabet soup that must be marvelous for non-Lutherans to understand. UELC, there were two ALCs. So Swami Synod, there was another one for you, because if you weren't finished, if you weren't finished, well, after all, and that. So I think there's that has to be said, yes.
I was just going to say, too, perhaps there's a difference not only with age, but maybe a maturity as far as a Luther, because I joined 2 years ago. And I'm not real proud of this, it's like one thing you remember. But I was addressing Christianity, so much of what was happening in churches, I said, oh, that's great, was it LCA or ACL or ALC? I didn't even know. Because I was really into Christianity, not the faction.
My brother is a pastor, had 2 whole mission churches when he started, and he went into some of the Sunbelt areas, and they said, you know, not only that, but what's a Lutheran? And he spent most of his time in his early and mid years of his parish, you know, trying to define that.
I think that's true. We get out of the Midwest, and that's really a question.
Yeah, I think there is a geographical difference there that I think has to be taken into account.
Look at the closeness of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod out here on the coast with us, and that's just not possible.
No, believe it, it's not possible.
I just think that we should underscore what has been said here. You know, this isn't new to us. We've done it before.
Yeah.
And I was on a national board with the ELC.
Yep.
And I stood on the national board immediately on the new ALC. And the same kind of thing happened, but we did it.
Yeah.
And I agree with Dick Mutter there. There's just no point in waiting for something to happen so we can't do it. They've decided to do it, and I would hope somehow they can accelerate that, because it's going to work. It's just a matter of doing it.
I think one of the vote kind of interesting, because what the vote was a kind of a compromise vote. There are those people who wanted to get all the bugs worked out before we voted to merge. And then there are others, such as yourself, saying, let's merge and then work out the bugs. And so we're saying, well, we'll commit ourselves to merge, but work out the bugs before we finally do it. So it's kind of we've been good Lutherans and walked the middle of the road.
Something happened along that same line. Remember when we merged at one time, and it had to be the American Lutheran Church. It had to have that
TELC.
Was a big deal for a little while. But gradually, you know, it didn't take very long, and that the T was dropped, and it was ALC, and nobody cares anymore. The Norwegians don't care about the T anymore.
And we, you know, we don't work together because we're structurally separated. They've got their education programs. They've got their district thing. In Alaska, I served for 7 years up there, and there's all these churches up in Alaska, but there's never enough of them really to make it worthwhile to get something together up there. We've got mostly it's ALC, but there's the LCA in Missouri and Wisconsin and Lutheran Church of the Brethren, and everybody's up there, but we're so spread out, and they've talked about why can't we share resources, and we're trying to do that, but it's such a pain
because you've got to cross all these different budget lines and you've got to do all that kind of stuff. So functionally, it's a waste of energy. But also, what's the witness to the world?
Yeah.
You know, if we're so divided, why should they pay any attention to us? I remember the story about a radio station, I think it was, down in California, that was offered to the church. And the Lutherans didn't get it because, well, they, you know, they're not together. And it went to somebody else. Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Lutherans couldn't get their act together. So everything was going to deal with them.
That's pretty hard for us to explain to you. You say, what's the difference?
Yeah.
You go,
oh. Actually, you know, historically, I think we're fantastic. I think Lutherans are doing, yeah. The fact that we've gone from 150 to 12. I think 12
yeah.
We count right now.
And three major ones.
With really everybody in three majors. Yeah. Is a phenomenal thing when you turn around and look at the other denominations that are frantically fracturing themselves all over the place.
The thing is, so few people understand the history. I didn't have a clue. I understand it at all until I did a research project on it, and I was fascinated and like you said, I was impressed that we had come this far and amazed that the mergers had happened as quickly as they had, and I didn't realize how new some of the mergers had been, and you don't notice. I never knew how the ALC, which I grew up in, had been so divided just years previous. And you don't notice the scars any longer. There aren't any, really. They've healed over. And
first question I ask, that is almost always asked in my membership class, is, what's the other Lutheran church downtown? It's Missouri Synod. But it's always, why are the two Lutheran churches? And that's sometime in that first hour and a half, that question will come up.
And I think the healing response is to tell that story in terms of history,
yeah,
rather than try to describe it in terms of current doctrinal
yeah
differences.
Oh, yeah, right.
And
always
the
story.
And also to rejoice in the differences. Yeah. We're not. That's the whole reason we don't have one Protestant denomination. That's why we have the Baptists and the Episcopalians and everything else, because we all find a different way to worship fulfilling. And there, I wouldn't want to convert my Missouri Synod friends to ALC-LCA because they have a different way that's fulfilling to them and their faith. And we should appreciate one another's faith in that respect.
Yeah, an Episcopalian friend of mine in our intimate conversations we had with the Episcopalian congregation in our town, we're a town of about 9,000 people, stuck out in eastern Oregon. Nearest LCA church to us in Oregon is 260 miles. There's some LCA closer the other way, so we feel somewhat isolated. But it was interesting. He accused the Lutherans of, you know, the problem. He said, you taught everybody how to translate the Bible into the vernacular of the people. Now everybody can read it. Now they all have their own translation and interpretation, and now what have you got? You got all these denominations.
Yeah.
And so it's somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but it's...
Is it a major problem that in order to make this merger a necessity and the need for spelling out in detail everything? Many of those problems would perhaps not be resolved if it were presented to see the ALC, if they had to now make a statement relative to that, regardless of what the other is. Isn't that a case where we're forced to take a stand on a lot of these perhaps divisive issues?
I just don't know. I think one thing I sure wish I had said before when there were more people here, but one reason that it has to go slow is that they are corporations. After all, they are incorporated. We are in a world where we have to deal with legal matters dealing with pensions and funding and all sorts of things. And, you know, no matter how hard you might try, some of those things just simply take time to get all the legal stuff out of the way. And it's for some people, that's very important because there are differences, for instance, in the pension plans.
Right.
Some of them are not just, and some of them aren't just matters of greed, but some of them are matters of fairness. Or
yes,
there are some of us, for instance, that would argue that a pastor, you know, should receive a pension based on the number of years of his service, with regardless of what he was paid. So that, you know, to encourage pastors to go into those small, struggling congregations, or even some have proposed the pastor to be paid on the basis of experience, irrelevant how large a congregation they serve. Some of those kinds of struggles.
Yeah.
I think I want them to go slow. I'm not in a hurry. We're doing fine. We'll get there. Now that we have the foretaste, you know, the kind of taste now, and we're on our way, and we can celebrate that. But what I want to see them do is take very careful attention to these structures and begin to see if they can't be made to serve us more. In the LCAs, there are times when I see these guys come in with white patent shoes and white belts and they come up from the Southwest too sometimes. We call them the wise men from the East, and you know, we really don't have a lot of confidence in them. There is a distance sometimes in the church. Our synod, when Gib Fellman was being toasted the other night as he retired, someone was mentioning the fact that he's the president of a synod that covers a third of all of the... Alaska's in there.
Yeah.
A third of all of the landmass of Northern America. United States. And that's kind of an incredible territory. The idea of smaller, more intimate, diocesan kinds of structures that maybe were Puget Sound area up to Bellingham would be one group. And down into the Portland area, or I'm not sure how it'll all be shaped. They're difficult things, but to develop a greater sense of intimacy and cooperation and closeness in the church, structures that work better. What do we need in this age? Maybe it's different than what we needed in a previous time, or like the LCW, LBW. The LBW is not just taking the old things and putting them together in a new shape. It was something new, and there was some excitement that came out of it, whereas the SBH was a rewrite of something that existed before, basically. And what I want in this new church is something that's going to give us a structure that's going to assist us in ministry.